Good afternoon, everyone. I am calling to order a meeting of the House Committee on Rules for Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. Happy Valentine's Day and happy birthday, Oregon.
Yay.
I'm going to open an informational meeting for an overview on government ethics and the Oregon Government Ethics Commission and call up Ron Bearson, Dan Golden, and Allison Keen. Welcome. Thank you for being here. Please just remember to say your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Ron Bearson. I'm the Executive Director of the Ethics Commission.
My name is Marie Sheffers. I'm the Compliance and Education Coordinator for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission.
Hi, Allison Keen, co-chair of the Ethics, deputy chair of the Ethics Commission.
And I'm Dan Golden, and I chair the Oregon Governmental Ethics Commission currently.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
All right, so
take it away.
We have came here today. First of all, thanks for everybody for having us. And I was going to say happy state birthday too, but it's a little late now. Anyway, we wanted to go over just a little bit of what the Ethics Commission does. We are a commission that's been around since 1974. That came in a vote of the people in response to the Watergate scandal that created the Ethics Commission. The commission oversees a few areas of law. One of them is Chapter 244, the actual ethics laws that are out there. Another is the lobby regulations in Chapter 171. And then we have a small portion of the public meeting laws around executive sessions in Chapter 191. So the commission itself is made up of 9 members, and I actually had the some commissioners come in for you so that they could explain what the actual commission does. What we do as a staff here is we receive complaints from the public about public officials, either with violations of the ethics laws, the lobby laws, or, like I say, the executive session provisions of the public meeting laws. The other large thing that we do, in fact, probably the main thing that we do, is we educate the people that are in public official positions, because what we have to remember is that the majority of government in Oregon is a volunteer government. So most of your city councils, most of your planning commissioners that are out there are all volunteers. They're not paid like I am to be a state executive. So we have to remember that these folks come from doing, let's say, regular work out there, and all of a sudden they're in the government. And so it's important that we get out in front of those folks and we train them on what is expected of them as a public official, such as the declarations of conflicts of interest, the use of office provisions of the law, and of course the gift limitations that are out there for public officials. So that's really a big portion of what we do. We do have some new systems that are out there right now. We're going to go over those in a little bit with you and kind of give you a visual display of the electronic filing system, which all of you folks are a part of, having to file your statements of economic interest. And just so you know, I file them along with you, so we're all in the same boat there. But we're pretty pleased with this system, what it's done for the agency. We have a newer system that's out there, the case management system, and just recently we finished the first phase of that. So now all of the advice that the commission gives out, and that's all written advice that we give out, is posted on the website. That includes advisory opinions that the commission votes on, staff opinions, and advice that goes out underneath my signature. So everybody is getting the same advice at the same time. So if you ever have a question of us, feel free to call us, but look at our website to see if we've already answered that question that's out there. So that system, by the way, the case management system, is going to go further into helping our investigators, instead of collecting all kinds of paper, actually being able to put that into a digital file. So when people are asking us for record requests on complaints that we have adjudicated, we will have that digital file to be able to give them right away. So I'm going to ask the chair and vice chair to go ahead and talk a little bit about what the commission itself actually does.
Thank you, Ron, and thank you all for hosting us today. You know how to celebrate Valentine's Day, I have to say. And in honor of that, I wore my most festive tie. I'm Dan Golden. I travel 500 miles round trip and have for the last 2 years on the Ethics Commission from Klamath Falls, Oregon, where I serve as the county juvenile director of the Klamath County Juvenile Department. And for the past 2 years, I've been attending these meetings on a, I guess, 4 or 5 or 6 week basis, in which literally dozens of cases come before us in a whole variety of different postures. And we, you know, of course, look at the areas that that Ron outlined. I'm taken by just how seriously, you know, many of the folks that come to us regard the various actions of the commission. Many of those folks proceed in front of us as, you know, volunteers from small boards and commissions and municipal governments all over the state of Oregon. Many of the transgressions, if you will, they've been accused of are inadvertent. These are some complicated rules, some areas that, you know, are difficult for folks to interpret oftentimes. And so the commission, I think, rightly has adopted the mission of education and training for these officials throughout Oregon. I asked Ron before the meeting, well, how many folks do you think are trained every year? And he said probably about 2,000 to 2,400 local officials are given trainings by commission staff every year. And so, you know, I'm taken by the educational and preventative aspects of what we do as kind of our main mission. And then, of course, enforcement of laws as complaints arise and are presented to us are, in some respects, our secondary mission. There aren't quite as many of those as, of course, the trainings that we provide, probably a couple of dozen per meeting that come to us and that we analyze. And, of course, there have been a change in the timelines, you know, and everything that we're working with, and that's put a little bit more of a pace on commission activities. We have some bills that we're here to look at today as well, and we're eager to hear, you know, what you folks want us to comment on in terms of some of those bills. I will say that as the commission moves forward, I think we're having a fair impact across Oregon. I recently was talking with a county commissioner from my part of the state who, when he was a school board member, had been part of an action that the commission had actually levied a small fine. And it really impacted him in terms of his learning curve about his duties and responsibilities regarding executive sessions. And that's one of those areas that we commonly see complaints about. We commonly see you know, things coming to us and complaints of violations of executive session where folks stray from the subject matter that they've called the executive session for into some other areas, and they receive complaints, and there are some complicated rules regarding that, and so at any rate, we're there initially to train and educate our local widely distributed officials around the state. I think that is having a good effect throughout Oregon. So with that, Allison, do you have something you'd like to add?
Sure, thank you. Thank you for having us today. I'm fairly new to the commission. I just was appointed last year.
Can you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Allison Keene. I am the vice chair of the Ethics Commission.
Thank you.
I am an attorney, and I am the general counsel at Metro, and I've been there for 20-some years, and am fairly new to the Ethics Commission, having just been appointed last year. My appointment was initiated by the Senate Democrats, and as you know, that right now there is a requirement that there be 9 members of the commission, and it is divided among party lines, and then there are at least the appointments, and then there are some that are non-party affiliated. But I must say, once we're all there, there is no party affiliation in how we analyze issues. In fact, I really don't know who has been appointed by who. And it's I've been very impressed with the level of professionalism and seriousness with which the staff take their jobs, as well as the commissioners. I've also been quite impressed that the commission and the staff view this function, this ethics commission function, as really an educational opportunity. It's not a prosecutorial focus.
The idea, as has been mentioned, most of our public officials in Oregon are volunteers, and many of them don't have an attorney who regularly advises their public entity, and so they're doing the best they can. And when they make a mistake and they're before the commission, first of all, there's a real effort by staff to educate, and our first line of response if someone is found having violated one of the ethics rules is to send a letter of education. Because that's really the idea, is to make sure that the rules that and the laws that the legislature has passed are upheld and understood. It's not really in anyone's interest to just find violations. It's to make sure that they're understood. So I've been quite impressed with that, and also with the real seriousness that the commission takes its job in analyzing the recommendations of the staff, and the staff have been fantastic. I've been really, really impressed by it. So we're each appointed for 4-year terms, and I'm at the beginning of mine, and so far I've been very pleased, and think that your work and the legislature's laws are really being carefully applied. Thank you.
So just real quick, one of the things I'd like to talk about, again, this is Ron Burson, the Executive Director of the Ethics Commission, is the commission has a unique funding model for our agency. Back in 2007, we tried to find a way to fund the agency that was out of the general fund and more reflected the work that we did. And so at that time, the local governments came forward, and half of our budget is actually through local governments and assessment, and which is unique in state government. So when they're paying the bills for us, we try to provide them with the goods, and that goods is training to those local governments. And I can tell you that there's some cities out there that have gotten more than others, but I will tell you that there's a great effort trying to put out there to make sure that that small assessment that they pay each one of those entities, because there's about 1,700 entities that pay our assessment, that they get some value for that. So. Having said that, unless there's any questions, we can jump into our demo on the reporting system. So,
right ahead.
It's nice. So, like I said, we came out last year with the reporting system, and what the reporting system does is it captures all of our statements of economic interest and all lobby and client reports that are filed with the commission. Statements of economic interest need to be filed by April 15th of each year, and lobby and client reports are filed on a quarterly basis, the middle of January, April, July, and October. So what you do is you go to our website, the front page of our website, and you'll see on the left-hand side there, it says electronic filing system. So you'll click on there. And what I'm trying to show you is what folks will see coming into our system. So if you scroll down, you'll see that the agency has set up several tutorials, video tutorials out there for first-time filers or people that just want to have some information on how to file. So if you don't really know where you're going to begin with, you can look at those short tutorials, and they'll help you understand how to start filing your report. But if we go back up, what we'll actually do now is click onto the system. And first of all, I want to show you what the public would see. So the biggest thing is this reporting system does is it used to be all these were paper returns, and they came into our office and they set in a file cabinet. So somebody had to do a public records request to get that. Now we tried to fulfill those requests at no cost to folks by scanning in those records. But again, they were really kind of out of the public view. They were sitting in my office on Pringle Road. In that file cabinet. So here, the public simply clicks on. I went past me. So, clicks on the public view. Can you go back one? So I can show that. I'm sorry. So this is view or search public records. So they click on there. And we come in here. And so let's go ahead and do my SEI to begin with. So you click on filers. Statement of economic interest. We got to go back to 2016 because we haven't filed 17 yet. Type in my name. You don't have to know my old name. Just last name will do.
Oops.
Spell it right. I'm just kidding there. and click on a generate report. Scroll down, and there's my SEI. So you can click on there. You need to click. You're going a little too fast for me. I'm behind you. I'm sorry, Virginia.
Okay.
So, generate the report again. I'm sorry. So you can see, you can either hit view details or you can click on my last name, and they're much bluer on our screens than they are here. So I just want to kind of point that out, that we really are kind of directing that mouse for folks. So you click on my name, and so my report comes up here. So this is the jurisdiction that I have. And so there's my 2016 report. Click on there. And here's the actual, what I actually reported last year on my statement of economic interest. Not all that interesting. It's not asked for often, so that's why I brought it to you folks, so at least somebody would see it. But I have a little income and a couple properties in the state of Oregon, so there you go. So very easy for the public to go out and see my statement of economic interest. So let's go back, and I also have the was the privilege of also being a lobbyist, because I lobby for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And so let's go out and look at, I'm gonna look at my registration. And you'll see here again, you have the same option of either using my last name, and like I say, it's highlighted, or view details. You'll see a lot of similarities in the system, but we click on my last name, and it comes out who I am, what my role is. My role as a lobbyist, what I've expended, and any outstanding penalties that I have, which we hope is zero. I try to file timely. I got to be the one person. Make sure you do that every time. Otherwise, my commissioners would be upset with me, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for your service. And thank you for showing me this. If you look at your lobbyist one, do the numbers all say zero because you're not paid to be a lobbyist? You know what I mean? Because you don't get paid to be a lobbyist in a contract outside of...
Well, we'll actually show the client report, where we'll actually show some money on it, because... What I do is I take a percentage of my income that the state pays me, and I figure a percentage of my job is to lobby, and you'll see that my different quarters change depending on if there's a session going on or there isn't a session going on. But the reason it says zero here is what this report is requiring me to report is the amount that I expended on legislative or executive officials. And I don't expend any money on legislative or executive officials. So that's why it says zero. Can you show the individual reports?
We're on registrations right now.
Okay, yeah, so let's go out to the reports, and I think that might help with the question. So that was just my registration. So that was me just telling the state I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. So these are actually the reports that I put out, and you'll see that I have all four reports in 2016. Again, that zero reflects the amount that I've expended on legislative or executive officials while lobbying. If you click on my name, you can see the actual quarters and what has been expended. And like I say, you can click on any one of those quarters too and see the report. So it's, again, I'm fairly boring, but I just want you folks to be able to see how easy it is for the public to navigate through this system and see the individual's accounts. So let's go back out really just real quick and look at my client, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And again, you get a similar thing with my name on it, because I'm the lobbyist for that. So go ahead and click on there. And there you'll see the total amount expended I have down is $8,550. And below there, you can kind of see in the quarters, you can see in first quarter of 2016, there was a short session there that spent a little bit more money than in the non-session times. So this is the amount that I estimated out of my wages that I spent in lobbying. And so that's each one of my returns. So any questions? So what's going to happen in another month or so, in the middle of March, you folks will be getting an email from my office that says it's time to file your SEI and it's open. And this time when you click on your SEI, if you have filed in the past, it will pre-populate the areas. Can you go back to my SEI just really quick? It'll populate areas on the SEI that can be pre-populated from the prior year, hopefully saving you a little bit of time going through and filling that out, such as income, businesses, properties that are out there. Of course, you can add and subtract to that depending on what's happened over the last year. So that was something that Representative Nathanson had asked us to put into the system, and I think it was a great idea. And I will tell you that I've had a chance to test that actually in production, and I have seen it work under my own SEI it did pre-populate. So if you scroll down, just like say sources of income, those four sources of income on my SEI when I pull it up after March 15th, that will be pre-populated, as will my real property in the state of Oregon. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Don't go anywhere, Ron. You're up in the next queue. I will close the informational hearing, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2298. You're all welcome to speak.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2298 requires all candidates who will appear on a primary or general election ballot to file a statement of economic interest with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. It comes to you today. We have not determined the revenue or the fiscal impact.
Chair, members of the committee, I've asked Marie Sheffers to go over this bill with you folks, and all of us be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Marie Sheffers. I think I said that earlier, but just for the sake of the record, I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 2298, which is kind of an unenviable task because the old statute is very confusing. So that's really why we're here, is if you look at ORS 244-050 sub 4 and sub 5, which are the subsections we're trying to change here. We've gotten some pushback from minor party candidates because the wording in here is pretty confusing. So the old statute uses the words general election, preceding primary election, the primary election, the filing deadline for the primary election, the filing deadline for the statewide election, the filing deadline for the statewide general election. And so back in 2013 and 2014, we got a couple of requests for commission advisory opinions on whether or not minor party candidates had to file statements of economic interest. It's pretty clear in here that every person who is a candidate for the primary election on April 15th of each year, and these are only candidates for the position specified in ORS 244-050, so that is any judicial officer, the governor, secretary of state, state treasurer, attorney general, commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry, district attorneys, members of the legislative assembly. Anyone who's a candidate for those offices at the primary election will already be registered as a candidate, will have already filed as a candidate on April 15 of each year. So those people are already filing statements of economic interest. What happens is that there are candidates who are write-in candidates at the primary election or who are filing as minor party candidates between 15 days after the primary election and 70 days before the general election. And the old language in this statute is confusing enough that we've gotten some pushback from minor party candidates saying, you can't make me file based on the language in here. This is an old, relatively old statute. I don't want to make anyone feel old. It's from 1991. So, and looking back at what was said then, It was pretty clear that they were intending to make everyone who was a candidate for those positions file. So what we're trying to do here is to say everyone who becomes a candidate after the primary, so everyone, or starting with the primary, everyone who becomes a candidate as a write-in candidate, a minor party candidate, independent, anything like that, will file a statement of economic interest not later than the 40th day before the statewide general election. That gives between the 70th day before the general election and the 40th day for the Secretary of State's office to get us notification of who has filed, who's going to be on the statewide general election ballot, us to give them notice, and then for them to file that statement of economic interest. So it's really an attempt to clear up some very confusing language under the old statute that said things like, they apply to persons who do not become candidates until 30 days after the filing deadline for the statewide general election. It's difficult to imagine who would be a candidate who had not filed by the deadline for the statewide general election. So this is our attempt to clean that up. It will kind of lead into what Ron's going to talk about for the next case, because this language is so confusing, when we get a legal challenge to it, when we get pushback, we really can't go to a contested case hearing, because as you'll see when Ron talks, we have to pay every time we lose, and the language is too confusing. So just a little lead in.
Chair Williamson, I just want to emphasize.
You go ahead and put your name on the
sorry.
Record because we're
Dan
on
the Golden, bill. Chair you, Dan. Of the Oregon Governmental Ethics Commission. The legislation is not an attempt to single out any party or group of parties or anything like that. It's an attempt to level the playing field so the same rules apply to everyone, and it creates a transparency into what SEI filers are being required to do from other parties now. That's what we're trying to do.
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Thank you. And one question either one can answer from a staff standpoint is why apply it to write-ins? Because while someone may aspire to be a write-in, it takes voter decisions to actually write them in to make them a candidate. So I can understand minor parties, but, you know, if I had a dollar for every time someone pronounced their writing, they're going to win a write-in, I'd be a rich guy. I mean, that just seems vague.
Thank you, Representative McLean. What we're getting at here is not that someone who's a write-in at the general election would be filing a statement of economic interest, but someone who had been a write-in and then accepted the candidacy. I'm not an elections expert, so I can't tell you exactly the process, but I don't think you can force someone to be a candidate on the statewide general election, even if a lot of people wrote them in on the primary. So the write-in situation is if someone is written in on the primary ballot, mm-hmm. And then accepts that nomination for their party and becomes a candidate on the statewide general election ballot in November. So they're still taking that action of accepting the nomination from their party, and then they would be filing before the statewide general election.
Okay.
So their name would be appearing on the ballot at the statewide general election.
All right, that makes sense. Thank you for clarifying. So another way to put it is, as you finished with, if your name does appear on a general election ballot, regardless of how it originated, we need you to file an SEI.
Right, and so the language here says each candidate described in subsection 1, which is the positions I listed earlier, who will appear on the statewide general election ballot and who was not required to file a statement of economic interest under the previous subsection, so they were not a major party candidate on April 15, essentially, shall file with the commission a statement of economic interest.
Okay, that clarifies it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2298 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2299.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2299 repeals requirement that Oregon Government Ethics Commission pay attorney fees for persons prevailing in contested case hearings. We have not received the fiscal or revenue impact at this time.
Great, thank you. And go ahead and, since we're on a new bill, make sure to state your name for the record. Thank you.
Yes, Chair. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate you having me here today. What this bill is attempting to do is that the Oregon Government Ethics Commission is the only regulatory body that I can find anyway that is required to pay attorney fees if we lose a contested case. What we're asking for today is to treat us like every other regulatory agency out there that underneath the Administrative Procedures Act that you can recover fees if basically our actions are unmerited or not warranted at that time. So the problem with this attorney fees regulation that we have on here now is I feel, and that's again what I really like the members of the commission to talk about, is that the commission itself looks to settle most cases and not go to contested case because the contested case, well, we just don't know what will happen at times. And like with Marie had talked about in the previous bill, when we were asked to take this case to contested case, I did not want to do that because the language is not clear, and therefore if I lose, I pay the attorney fees. I think it does the agency a disservice because there may be some areas of law inside of the ethics laws that it would do well for the courts to actually opine on that, to actually look at that and see, is the commission interpreting it correctly at this time, or do we disagree with that? But the commission has been reluctant to do that, take those cases to contested case. And so what we're really asking for is that this commission is treated like every other regulatory body in the state of Oregon, that we operate under the Administrative Procedures Act, and the requirement for us to pay attorney fees upon losing a contested case is repealed.
Representative McLean.
Thanks, Ron. That's ironic. I think we should make, as you said, agencies all the same. I'd like to expand that rule to the other agencies because you said it, I mean, in essence, what I would call the better argument, and that is that you weigh attorney fees and whether you have the whether you use the discretion to move forward. And I can tell you, you know, I mean, I certainly don't want to deprive anyone attorney's fees. I mean, Representative Rayfield and I would be advocates for making sure attorneys are paid robustly for their advocacy. Nevertheless, that is a common complaint to legislators that agencies are aggressive and they pull people into contested cases. It costs citizens, companies, and others money. And then they go through it all and they win, and they're left with a $100,000 attorney fee bill, and they're very frustrated. So it is, I must confess, when you put it that way, it makes it sound like we should have the reverse bill. I may have to drop a bill and say, let's expand this to all agencies to make agencies really take a sober approach before they bring action, because when you drag, you know, when you put a citizen through that rigor of government scrutiny, perhaps there should be a sobering conversation amongst the agency officials before we do it.
Chair Wilmington, Vice Chair McLean, I guess I should have said it backwards then. So, I will tell you that we are not eliminating the ability for citizens to actually take us to task if we are out of order or aggressive or overly aggressive in our pursuit of complaints. So they would still have that remedy. Doesn't take it out. It just eliminates the certainty of the attorney fees. And I will tell you that my commission, all the commissions that I've worked for, because I think Allison had said earlier that commissioners on my commission are going to be on there for 4 years. And so in the 10 years that I've been the executive director, I can tell you that I've worked for several commissions, out there, that they have an expectation of me that the cases that I bring to them, that not only have I vetted out all the facts, but that I'm applying the law in the way that they see fit. And that's a 9-member commission out there. So I would say that the people, and like I say, they're not required to be represented by attorneys to come before the commission. Many times they are, but I will tell you that my commission would not tolerate me bringing unsubstantiated charges against folks or trying to push a violation that really wasn't there. And I say they can speak to it more, but I'm very careful in what is brought forward. And I think if you look at my record over the last 10 years, you don't have any of those kind of, we've kind of overstepped our bounds of authority. I mean, there's been some talk about interpretation of the law. But again, I think that what we're asking for is that the people still have that ability to take us to task if they think we've overstepped, but that is the same procedure for everyone that's out there. So I appreciate your
if I may follow up, I certainly see your point. Perhaps your record of discretion was enabled by the downside of having to pay a successful litigant her or his attorney's fees. But, I certainly trust your commission. I mean, your chair is one of my closest friends. I mean, and I pointed to the commission, and I think your track record has been very good in the state. But nevertheless, I'm reluctant, to be frank, to pull back. I think one of the things that increases the analysis on whether to proceed, not decrease it, out of a justification of sameness. Ironically, one could argue that what you're saying is because other agencies don't have to take that consequence into consideration, it's not fair that you have to. But but it is an issue out there. People get very frustrated when they prevail in a contested case and they are left sometimes as much as $100,000 in attorney's fees defending their behavior, and they have no remedy. And while you, under the APA, they say if there's no reasonable justification to bring it, and maybe Rayfield can correct me on this, that there can be recovery, but I don't know of anyone who's ever prevailed in that standard. You're going to have to convince me that this bill is merited, because I think it might be a good check before you bring someone through and they have to incur attorney's fees fighting it. But, I am just the vice chair, a co at that. I'm sure that the majority party may see it different, but I don't know.
Representative
Chair,
Kenema.
Vice Chair, I appreciate your comments there. And I will say that as far as the effort goes on really kind of digging into the facts and knowing the facts coming in, I will tell you, and I would invite you to come to a commission meeting, that the commission that I said before grill us pretty hard. Make sure that we have all those facts before they're making decisions. And if we don't have those facts, they are not all that pleased with us. And so we do a very good job, or we work very hard to make sure that we have all those questions answered. And so I don't believe it's this attorney fee thing that makes my staff actually do a really in-depth and make sure that we're able to answer all those questions. It's really our expectation, meeting the expectation of my commission to do that. The other thing is the one thing that we lose out on, and I would really like to benefit from as being the executive director, is at times making sure the courts do look at some of these cases that are maybe not as clear, because we all know the ethics laws, there's some gray area inside the ethics laws, and it would be nice to have some outside source, the judiciary side anyway, make some of those decisions and not just our agency doing advisory opinions on it. So I just want to assure you that I'm not here to convince you, I just want to make sure that you know that we work very hard to kind of fill in, make sure all those blanks are filled in, all our I's are crossed, and our I's are dotted and T's are crossed before I go to this commission, because their expectations are high of me. And if you being friends with the chair and knowing the chair, you've known him for years, he has high expectations, and we try to meet those. So I just want to assure you of that.
Thank you, Ron.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess I have grave concerns about your suggestion. On the one hand, it seems like an appropriate thing. If there isn't a good threat, and that minimizes people's concerns, and I buy that. What I think is remarkably different in this case is two things. One is that I think this remarkably emboldens the commission, because now what's the risk? The second thing that I think is germane and different from many cases is, for the most part, persons, public figures who have ethics complaints filed against them are judged and written about extensively in the newspapers. And huge damage is wreaked on their person, their families, and on their reputation. Sometimes justified. In fact, maybe more than sometimes. But in those instances where it's not, this prolongs it. An appealed case will take, what, 6 months if you have a good attorney? A year? This is a long time for a public person to get barbecued in their local press, and maybe statewide press, in fact. I find this totally unacceptable from my perspective.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The record, as far as has the Ethics Commission ever been required to pay attorney's fees on a defendant that has prevailed?
Chair Williamson, Representative Barreto, that was before I got here, but yes, we have had to pay those attorney fees.
I do have to say, I had a federal a tax audit and we defended that. It cost us $24,000. They dropped the case. There was nothing to it. I mean, I would have considered it a frivolous lawsuit, but we had no recourse in getting those dollars back. And it seems when the government, you know, can sue or can push for that, and you have to defend yourself through litigation, it seems like we ought to have, if we prevail, the opportunity to get those attorney's fees back. A different case, I mean, you know, a federal audit versus ethics commission, but same principle.
Other questions for the panel?
Yes. So I just wanted to, with all these lawyers around here, I thought maybe I'd get something clarified. So
I'm
if the
not a lawyer.
Can I bill for that?
File a suit.
So I just want to clarify. So if you're an agency that brings a suit forward that doesn't really is baseless or considered frivolous, wouldn't there still be a remedy from the party that you were trying to sue?
Chair Williamson, Representative Hovey, yes. The Administrative Procedures Act does have that remedy in there. Again, that is... they need to ask the courts for that and show that it was there was no merits to the case. But yes, that is there.
So even if this bill were to go forward and we repealed this section, that would still remain.
Yes, we are not uncorralled completely at that point. No, we would still be underneath the same guidelines that any other agency has out there. There just wouldn't be the certainty of having to pay attorney fees if we take a case let's just say the law isn't as clear, like we talked about in the prior bill, where there's been statute on the books for quite some time on third-party candidates filing their statements of economic interest, but with the complexities of the different terms used, statewide election, general election, you know, primary, after primary, and the time frames in there, it was unclear. And I will tell you that a third-party candidate has tried to take us to task, and I have resisted going to contest a case on that because I'm not quite sure that that a judge would rule in our favor because of the ambiguity in the language. So we're trying to clear that up here, but that's just one example. And so we know that the ethics laws do have some gray areas in it. And like I say, I would appreciate the judicial branch's interpretation of some of that gray area going through a contested case.
Just to follow up to Representative Holby, and I believe this.
You're not going to bill me for this,
right? I won't bill you. Rayfield may bill you, but I believe the standard under the APA is, in essence, no rational basis. So that if an agency brings it, loses, the prevailing litigant can ask for fees, but that the showing is that they had no rational basis to bring it in law or fact. That's a standard that is seldom shown. It's a pretty wide gulf between did you prevail, if so, you get fees, and did the agency, you prevailed and the agency had no basis. But, you know, so that wide gulf, I'd be curious, and I'm sure the Department of Justice could probably tell us, is how many people have prevailed under the APA against a state agency for that attorney fee provision. My guess is it would be very, very minute.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. When you make a decision about whether or not you're taking a case forward, is the Attorney General acting as a lawyer of advice to you, or are you sort of on your own because of your sort of unique role?
Chair Williamson, Representative Nose, Marie Sheffers again. If I could maybe step back a little bit and explain a little bit more of our process so that the committee will understand how we get to the point of a contested case.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So what cases begin at the commission one of two ways. Most of them start with a complaint, a signed complaint from a member of the public, another public official, someone who sees a problem and sends us a complaint. We get a lot more things that purport to be complaints than we open. People complain about prison officials, they complain about DHS taking their child away, they complain about a lot of things that are not in our jurisdiction. So that's one way they're open. The other way is usually media reports that we take to the commission and open a case on the commission's own motion. So the commission is then, the nine members are making the decision about whether or not there's enough information that suggests a violation of Oregon government ethics law that we would go forward to even
based
opening.
Based on an OPB story or an Oregonian story or?
Something like that. All of those two things do is open a preliminary review, which is the first 30-day stage. In those 30 days, we gather whatever information we can gather. We don't have subpoena powers yet or anything like that, but we gather whatever information we can gather. Often there's a letter of response from the person who's the respondent, and present a report to the commission at the next meeting after those 30 days. The commission then makes a decision about whether or not there is even enough evidence to move into a full investigation. So again, we have to get 5 votes out of the commission to move into a 180-day investigation. During the 180-day investigation, and our DOJ counsel signs off as having reviewed that preliminary review report. At the end of the 180-day period, we've collected more information, had more time to review it, issued subpoenas, whatever was necessary, and write another report saying either we think this case should be dismissed or we think there is evidence of these violations of Oregon government ethics law by a preponderance of the evidence. Our DOJ counsel reads that as well and signs off on it, and then we present it to the commission. The commission makes the determination by a majority vote, or sometimes they disagree with our analysis and dismiss it, even though we've recommended findings of violation. But they make a determination about whether or not to make preliminary findings of violation. So that's the point at which, after kind of having gone through this long process where there are quite a few stages where either the case isn't opened, it's dismissed at the end of preliminary review, or fairly commonly dismissed at the end of investigation, after those preliminary findings of violation is when the respondent has the opportunity to request a contested case hearing. So it's been reviewed quite a few times, at least twice by the commission themselves, sometimes 3 times, before it gets to the point where the respondent can request a contested case hearing.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank the witness for explaining that, because I think I understand how this works now a lot better. I mean, at the 1,000-foot level, it sounds like you don't just get to decide. You're getting a lot of advice, you know, and there's an argument with another lawyer who's not on the commission, but is, in theory, I would hope, you know, informed or understands how your area of the law works. Kind of like, you know, in my other job at my union, I don't get to just take anything out of the commission either. I got to consult somebody who is not as passionate about it or familiar and see if it sort of passes another objective test of whether or not there's some there or I'm just too close to it.
The DOJ attorney does attend the meetings and is part of that, and they are also signing off on all of those reports. And then going back to Representative McLean, the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, it actually uses the term state agency acted without a reasonable basis in the fact of, in fact or in law. So that's what they use, and basically it gives the judge the ability to allow the petitioner reasonable attorney fees. And again, Department of Justice might know how many times that's used, but it isn't the highest. I mean, it isn't a super high standard. I mean, we have to be, our actions have to be based in fact. So.
Any other questions?
One last question. I'm just curious about when you go through this administrative law process, is the person or the judge that's adjudicating this, is it a member of the Oregon Ethics Commission, or is it through the Office of Administrative Hearings?
Chair Williamson, Representative Holby, the first contested case that people can go to after that preliminary finding violations that Maria talked about earlier is they would go before an administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearing. They've already been before the commission on at least two occasions, and the commission has made their votes. And to be clear, those votes have to be in our with our current commission, at least five commissioners. It's not a majority of the commissioners that are there. It has to be five. And so it would go to an administrative law judge. They would write an opinion on that, basically an order on that. If the person disagreed with that order, or if the agency still disagreed with that order, then that's when, as Representative Kinnemer had talked about, you would go to the appellate court. So the appellate court would go from there. So, yes.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2299 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2577.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2577 requires lobbyist statements filed with Oregon Government Ethics Commission to identify each bill lobbyists lobbied on, whether lobbyists lobbied in favor or opposition, each legislative topic the lobbyists lobbied on, each entity that hired the lobbyist, and how much money entity paid the lobbyist to lobby on the topic. It requires the Oregon Government Ethics Commission to make additional information available in a searchable online format. It expands definition of lobbyist to include person who holds position with public body or private entity and whose job responsibilities include lobbying. Requires lobbyists to register and file a statement with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission within 3 days of meeting any registration requirements. This measure comes to you. We do not have the revenue or fiscal statement quite yet.
Representative Rayfield.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Rayfield, state representative from House District 16. Good to see you all here today. This bill, you know, its originations came from the pursuit of kind of true transparency on how bills are influenced and passed within this building. It also answers the question about how you unite an entire group of lobbyists against one single bill, where you have the ACLU, OEA, and AOI hand in hand walking together. It is a feel-good bill, at least for one side of the equation. What I wanted to do is talk to you a little bit about the vision and background behind this bill. In the campaign side of the world, we have a lot of transparency in terms of what helps us elect officials, all the transparency on the campaign contributions coming in, and so we know exactly who is influencing the folks that get to this building. But once you get inside this building, We don't have a lot of information on what is actually influencing the decision-making process inside this building, and that's what this bill is really about. And so what I want you guys to imagine is, on one hand, if you went to the website, that which you saw a little bit earlier, and you typed in House Bill 1005, it comes up. On the left-hand side, you would see all the people supporting the bill. On the right hand, you'd see all the people opposing the bill. You might have people that are monitoring the bill or seeking amendments. You could then click on the individual or the entity that is hiring that individual and find out exactly how much they're paying into the state to actually influence the policy. And as you saw earlier, we actually already have clients report what they're paying their lobbyists on activity. And so that's something to kind of take into account. We already have most of this. Really what this bill is aimed at is focusing on requiring lobbyists to talk about what they're supporting and imposing. And so what we want to do is, Ryan Beeston in my office is here. He has kind of studied all the other states that actually have these laws, and we want to run you through what the other states do. Before I do that, I want to give you a real visual in terms of what this could look like. And Colorado is one of the best states at implementing this. And so what we'll do is put you up here and kind of show you a little bit about what we could have in Oregon. The clicker is not working.
We could have that in Oregon.
Look at this. There we are. All right.
Prophetic.
Go kick it.
PowerPoint. Does anybody know? Oh, the suspense is amazing in the House Rules Committee this afternoon. Feel the tension in the lobby. There we are. So this in Colorado, you can see they have taken after Oregon in many ways about having a great picture of their Secretary of State at the top of the website. Really appreciate that. This is a bill search result, and what you can see, these slides are also on OLIS. This is for House Bill 1005. You can see all the various lobby names, the client, you can see the position, where you'll see amending, monitoring, supporting, and opposition. Obviously, all of those are hyperlinks within that where you could click on the lobby or the actual client name. This is a lobbyist summary, very similar to some of the lobbyist summaries that you saw a little bit earlier, but it's a little bit more in depth, where you can click on a full list of clients, you can click on a history, and actually see what they're paid. So we'll click to the next one. This is a monthly report. This is where you'll see the income of this lobbyist month by month. You can actually even click in. This is a report in mid-year. You can actually click into one of the months, and you'll get this. A detailed reporting of every client and how much that client has paid to the lobbyist. And I think one of the fun things, this individual, because it is public record, the Mobile Home Parks Owners Association of Colorado got $6,000 this month. The Widefield Water and Sanitation District paid this lobbyist $2,500 a month. And it goes on and on. I mean, you can find lots of different things like this. Then you have, this is what a cumulative disclosure statement for a specific year, which actually shows all the money is paid towards lobbying. And then you have your lobbyist client list. And again, you can kind of click through these entities as well. So this is the type of vision that we can have in Oregon as we work together. And so Ryan is going to talk to you a little bit about what the existing laws kind of reinforce what the Ethics Commission already talked about, and then dig into what are the various laws in each of the states. And what you'll see is what we're actually going to talk about today in terms of Oregon is a little less stringent than Colorado.
Thank you, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Beeston, and I'm Representative Rayfield's Legislative Director. So as Representative Rayfield said, I'm going to discuss the requirements that are currently in effect in Oregon and then go through the other states and what they have as reporting requirements. So currently in Oregon, they're required to file quarterly reports, and lobbyists as well as their employers are required to file reports. In the lobbyist reports, they're required to file the total amount of money spent by them for the purpose of lobbying. This is then itemized further by food, refreshments, and entertainment, printing, postage, and telephone, advertising and PR, and education and research. They also must include, for expenditures that are more than $50 on one occasion, the name of the official, the date, the name of the payee, purpose, and amount of expenditure. Their employers, as you saw during the earlier presentation, must report the total amount of money spent for lobbying activities. This excludes living and travel expenses. And similarly to lobbyists, however, for each expenditure more than $25 on more than one occasion, the employer must report the name of the official, the date, the name of the payee, purpose, and amount of expenditure. This does not include the expenses that the lobbyists reported on their reports. So we identified six states that have relatively comprehensive reporting requirements. Comprehensive to us included the reporting requirement that they discuss either bills, legislation, or other government processes that they attempted to influence. So Colorado, Idaho, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and South Carolina are the states that I'll focus on. So the first question is, who has to report? In Colorado, they require professional lobbyists, lobbying firms, state officials, and state employees who are engaged in lobbying to report. Idaho, they require just lobbyists to report. In Massachusetts, they require executive and legislative agents, their employers, as well as groups that don't employ lobbyists but spend more than $250 per year lobbying. New Jersey, they require government affairs agents who receive or spend more than $2,500 a year to lobby, and also lobbyists, which in New Jersey means lobbyists, employer, or principal lobbyist. Rhode Island similarly requires lobbyists, principals, and persons who engage in lobbyists.
Question?
Sure.
How is lobbying defined in each of these states? Is it a similar definition to Oregon? Are you getting to that? Okay, never mind.
And then South Carolina finally requires similarly lobbyists, principals, and state agencies. The next question is, how often are lobbyists required to report? As we know, in Oregon, they're required to report quarterly. Some states, as you can see, have monthly, quarterly, and all the way up to biannually or annually. In the states that require monthly reporting, there's typically a 15-day window to file the report. So if you're filing this month's report, it would be due by March 15th. Annual or biannual reports typically have a little bit longer given the more in-depth reporting requirements, and they typically have about a month to finish that report. So in Colorado, as I said earlier, professional lobbyists and state agencies must report. Professional lobbyists must report the source and amount of all income from lobbying, expenditures made for gifts or entertainment, as well as the name of the public official. Payments that are made for mass communication in which a lobbyist or their employer calls to be published and that is relating to lobbying. The nature and specifics of the legislation, which includes the bill number and position on the bill. It also applies to standards, rules, or rates that the lobbyist is attempting to influence. As Representative Rayfield said earlier, the positions on the bill in Colorado are supporting, opposing, amending, or monitoring. State agencies in Colorado are required to report the amount of each expenditure of public funds that are used for lobbying, the legislation that's being lobbied on, and finally, they must estimate the time spent on lobbying or the preparation for lobbying by any state official or employee. Moving on to Idaho, lobbyists in Idaho similarly must report the total expenditures that they made or caused their employee to make. This does not include direct payments made to the lobbyists, so they don't have to report their actual salary. They also must report the name of the public official who received an expenditure greater than $100 and include the date, payee, purpose, and amount of expenditure. They also must report expenditures that benefited the members of the public official's household if this exceeds $100. $110. And just for brevity, you guys have these slides. We'll just fast forward and get to the points that discuss the up or down or positions on legislation or rules. So here you can see in Idaho, they are required to report the subject matter of the proposed legislation and then the number of each bill, resolution, or memorial. And then they also must report if they attempt to influence rules, rate making, procurement, contract, bid, financial services, or bonding. And finally, for appropriation bills that they support, they must enumerate the specific section or sections that they supported or opposed. In Massachusetts, similarly, executive and legislative agents must report. Unique to Massachusetts is that they must report campaign contributions on their lobbying forms in addition to the expenditures that are made for lobbying. These are more specifics about the types of itemization that is made. And finally, they must list all the bill numbers of legislation that they acted to influence if the bill number was specifically referenced in the meeting. And this is more expenditures that employers must report in Massachusetts. New Jersey, they require quarterly reports. On the quarterly reports, they require a description of the legislation or the category or type of legislation, regulation, or governmental process that they lobbied or attempted to influence. On the annual report is where they get into the expenditures similar to the other states that they require. And unique to New Jersey is that they require public officials or lobbyists to state whether they serve on any local or state commissions or boards, and then also list the date that the term expires. Rhode Island, in addition to the compensation, who paid for the compensation and the types of expenditures, they must also report campaign contributions in excess of 100 made to state officials, candidates, or PACs. In addition, they have to file statements which disclose the legislation by bill number or subject of the lobbying. In addition, and then names of the people that are lobbied and their employers then report the compensation and expenditures as well. Finally, in South Carolina, this is a pretty intensive slide, so we'll go through it pretty quickly. Luckily, the first point is the interesting one. They must do the name, number, or description of legislation, covered agency action, gubernatorial action, on which the lobbyist lobbied. Sources of income, itemized expenses. They actually have a provision which requires them to report the names of judiciary members that they've lobbied and itemize the expenses for that as well. So the principals also then report, similar as the other states, the expenses that they're making for the judiciary as well. State agencies must report the legislation or similar government actions that the lobbyists tried to influence. So this gets to Chair Williamson's question, what acts require duty to report? This is sort of gets to each state's unique definition of what lobbying is. There is a pretty dense definition for each, but just to highlight sort of the uniqueness, in Colorado, any attempt to influence the drafting, introduction, sponsorship, consideration, debate, amendment, passage, defeat, approval, or veto, those are all considered lobbying, as well as the preparation of an initial fiscal statement. Convening of a special session or specifying what business will be discussed at the special session, and then as well as drafting, consideration, amending, adopting, or defeating any rules, standard, or rate that the agency may be making. Idaho has a fairly straightforward definition which discusses attempts to influence the approval, modification, rejection, or to also develop or maintain relationships or promote goodwill with members of the legislative or executive branch. Further, they also extend these to attempts to influence rulemaking decisions, rate making, procurement, financial services, and other things like that. Massachusetts has a very similar definition to the former. However, it also includes influencing the governor's approval or veto of legislation. New Jersey's pretty similar in the sense that they require these attempts to influence legislation, regulations, or governmental processes as well. Unique to New Jersey is that actually they consider communication with the general public to be lobbying and that it's grassroots lobbying. Rhode Island, similar definitions as the previous, promoting, opposing, amending, or influence any action or inaction by any member of the executive or legislative branch. And finally, South Carolina, promoting, opposing through direct communication, trying to influence introduction or enactment of legislation, gubernatorial actions, agency actions, or also the consideration of the election or appointment of an individual to public office.
So this is what our bill, kind of going through, who has to report? And so we put that in here. It's basically lobbyists and lobbyist employers, basically what's already going on. How often do they have to report? Instead of doing monthly like a lot of these other states do, we would be doing quarterly. So we wouldn't be changing reporting requirements. Although I have to say, after talking with a lot of lobbyists in other states, there is actually some real serious arguments to reporting monthly. And you can imagine this from a legislative perspective. You file your bills in January. By the end of February, you get to see where absolutely every lobbyist is if they're taking a stance on your bill, which is helpful in terms of, you know, quite frankly, lobbyists speak highly of that in the other states, and also legislators do like that. Then we have, what do they have to report? So in this bill, basically each bill lobbied on, and whether they lobbied in favor, in opposition, or sought amendments to the legislation. They'd have to talk about each legislative topic that was not a bill that they lobbied on, and each person or entity that hired a lobbyist, and the amount person or entity paid that lobbyist. And then this is, gets back to, again, what Chair Williamson's initial thing is, how do we define lobbying? And you'll kind of see in the bill what we call engaged in lobbying activities, and the definition is influencing or attempting to influence legislative action through oral or written communication with legislative officials, solicitation of executive officials or other persons to influence or attempt to influence legislative action, or attempting to obtain the goodwill of legislative officials. And so that is House Bill 2577. What I would say is we've been working with the Capital Club for quite some time. They've been interested in having conversations with us. Some of the things we've been discussing is what acts would trigger the duty to report, so kind of the scope of the bills that we would be reporting on. We've talked about the labeling. What happens when you have a bill that you're working for amendments on, or maybe your position changes. And so there's different ways that you can implement this to where your final position on a bill at the given time is what you would do. And all these other states have successfully done this without issue. And then we've also talked about their workload. And what I ended up doing in our office, we had our interns and folks calling lobbyists in other states so that I could personally talk to them. I've talked to lobbyists in basically four of these six states. Two of them are going to testify today. And we really focused in on Colorado as they have the most stringent standards in terms of lobbying. And so what you're going to find is that generally they like these requirements. They think it's good for their practice. One of the individuals who will be testifying told me that the only thing that he really didn't like is that the Denver paper does a story each year on the most the most high-paid lobbyists, and he says he has to take his parents out to dinner because they think he makes a lot of money. That was his main complaint. And so, you know, as we look at this, you know, I mean, this is, you know, unpopular in this building, obviously. I've gotten text messages. I've been get stopped in the hallway. In fact, I was stopped in the hallway on the way here. You know, and my meetings sometimes get co-opted by folks talking about this, but I don't think any of us were elected to be popular inside this building. And I believe that we as elected officials, as lobbyists, have a duty to rebuild trust in our government. And true transparency about how policy is moved in this state is a really good step towards that goal. And the last thing that I would comment on, there is some online testimony from one of the lobbyists who couldn't testify, but I think their end of their statement summarizes it well. This system works well and is a great resource to the citizens and the lobbying community. And this is someone who lobbies for the Colorado Hospital Association, Colorado Beer Distributors, Comcast, Fresenius Medical Center, Pfizer, Uber, and a whole list of other lobbyists, I mean, clients. So, and that's on OLIS.
On hold.
Oh, great.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What year did the Colorado one take effect?
Actually, I believe it was passed in the mid 20th century, and that has recently been updated, I believe, in 2015. I'll have to get back to you on that, though, for the exacts.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. And obviously, I'll be around if you have questions.
Hi, Michael, are you on?
Yes.
Can hear us? This is Jennifer Williamson. I am the chair of the House Rules Committee, and we're ready. The committee's here. We can hear you. If you want to state your name for the record and give your testimony, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Beasley. I am the president of the 5280 Strategies, which is a governmental affairs and public relations firm located in Denver.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair, I had a chance to review House Bill 2577 and was asked to compare it to the practice and some of the law and regulation we have here in the state of Colorado as it relates to lobbyist disclosure and regulation. Colorado has had a similar type measure on our books since for at least 25 years. On top of voter-approved limitations on how long the legislature can meet, campaign finance limits, a ban on any gifts to legislators, and it's been part of a what the public understands, I believe, and appreciates as a strong ethics law as it relates to public officials here in our state. This bill is very similar to what we have in Colorado. We are required to disclose within a few days of being retained who our client is, report on a monthly basis what the value of that lobbying contract is, as well as any positions we take, whether it's amending, monitoring, supporting, or opposing. It's extremely popular, you can imagine, with the public, but with the media in particular. As I mentioned to Representative Rayfield earlier, once a year there's a story the press does on the top paid lobbyists, and that's usually at the time when I go to dinner with my parents, I end up buying dinner that month. There is value across the board in the public and private sectors for the public to know what's spent to influence decision makers like yourself. We've tinkered with the law over the last few years. There's to do a couple of different things. One, we amended our law a couple of sessions ago to require attorneys who are lobbying and not practicing law to disclose their clients. That has been considered a loophole in our laws. And just recently, our Secretary of State made available to the City of Denver his website where all of this information can be displayed, a link between Denver's local government registered lobbyists to his page, again, to allow the public to see how it works. For us, with a firm of close to 30 clients involved in both the public and private sectors, it's been a valuable tool to help keep the public and others interested in what we're up to. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yeah, Representative Rayfield.
Mr. Beasley, thanks for being here today. You might just talk about, you know, how many clients you have and how many bills you have and kind of what the, you know, how that workload is for you when you're inputting this into the system.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In Colorado, on any given legislative session, we're limited to 120 days. We see somewhere between 600 and 1,000 bills during that 120-day period. For someone like me, with the client base that we have, as I described earlier, we are actively involved with amending, monitoring, supporting, or opposing somewhere between 250 and 300 bills per session. And for those of you, an extension of that thought, those of you, if you go to Colorado.gov or go directly to the Secretary of State's website, you can see a very specific lobbyist section that is searchable by clients, by lobbyists. You and you can produce reports from that. We run on a fiscal year of July 1 through June 30th, and we are required in the July period to re-register as lobbyists. The fee for that and to maintain the electronic website of the Secretary of State fee is $40 per year.
Excellent. Thank you. Additional questions?
Just one follow-up.
Representative Rayfield.
And just one last follow-up, Mr. Beasley. Has this been a bipartisan or a partisan issue in Colorado?
You know, we have had, in the last 25 years, we've had, with the exception of 2 years, Republican secretaries of state, and the legislature in the last 10 years divided in both parties, but mostly Republican. It has been very bipartisan. There have been working groups convened by every Secretary of State that I've worked with over the last 20 years that will pull together working groups of lobbyists and legislators from both political parties or across the political spectrum to assist in rulemaking. In the bill that I just referenced from a couple of sessions ago, the approach has been bipartisan. Every Secretary of State that has run the website has been very open to making sure that the technology is not only user-friendly, but also makes it easy to do the reporting, so it's not an extra burden on the folks that are actually doing the reporting, which is, all been very beneficial and extremely helpful for all of us.
Excellent. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Beasley, for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was an honor. I wish you good luck.
Thanks. Take care. All right. Now, because we're in an old hearing room, we have to physically dial. We can't have the next person on hold down here. So.
Oh, what's there?
Yeah. It's not a rotary phone, so we've got that going for us.
Madam Chair, a question to Representative Rayfield. I noticed that he's the only sponsor of the bill. Do you anticipate any co-sponsors?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McLean. I would honor some sponsors. I have asked a few people, but so far no one has been interested in joining me on the legislation.
Yeah, I know that a lot of flu victims are often isolated. Not many people want to go in and invite them to attend the movies, for an example, with them or hang out at a party. I would imagine your isolation may last a while on this bill, but God knows we appreciate the effort.
Thank you.
Right.
It'd show your appreciation by signing.
Are you on the phone?
Hello?
Hi, this is Jennifer Williams, and I am the chair of the Oregon House Rules Committee, and we have you on speaker with the committee. I'd ask that you just say your name for the record, and then go ahead and start your testimony.
Okay, my name is Vicki Armstrong. I'm from Akron, Colorado.
Excellent.
And good afternoon.
Thank you for being here.
If you'd like me to go ahead and start, I will.
Yes, please do.
I am a current lobbyist in Colorado. I'm a former legislator. I am the former Secretary of Labor director in Colorado, and I am a Republican. I only brought up my party affiliation because I know that Representative Rayfield is a Democrat, and what I have to say today to me is not a partisan issue. Representative Rayfield contacted me a few days ago. And I'm assuming because I was a lobbyist in Colorado, we have no other connection, and I don't believe we have any mutual friends.
That's true for several of us.
Currently, I only have one client, but my views wouldn't change if I had the caseload that I had in my prior life. And when I say that, I'm semi-retired. I have two children still at home, and moved out of the Denver metro area a few years ago to take care of 6 of my children who are adopted. So they had some special needs, and I just kind of left the metro area. As a lobbyist with many clients and many bills to follow, I always had to keep my clients updated. And each state is different, I know, but having a computer-friendly system, and I think we have one in Colorado, you basically just re-record the info you are most likely informing your clients about. I was a lobbyist who made reports for my clients once a week with what was going on, you know, to remind them of what our position was, like the board had decided what the position was with, you know, my input, et cetera, or if we were against the bill, if it had been amended and all that. So that component was something that I had already done as a lobbyist. And really, when you're a legislator, I'm sure you all know, you're tracking a whole lot more bills than just the bills that a lobbyist is really involved in following, because you're following every bill that comes to your committee or onto the floor. The public wonders why a piece of legislation is passed. Sometimes they wonder why it was killed in committee or amended when there is no testimony. I've been in that position. I've been in a committee where it's just completely quiet. No one really has anything to say, and yet the bill may be amended, it may be killed, and you're sitting there going, I wonder what's going on. Well, I can tell you, as somebody that's been around that system for a while, I know. The hall or the hallways at the Capitol are usually when a lot of work has been done by lobbyists. And sometimes the lobbyists will come into committee and testify and tell you who they're representing, but much of the work is done in that hallway. They talk to you, they may give you a write-up on a piece of paper, but the public does not know why that bill was killed or amended or passed. They have no idea because they don't see anybody testifying. So I think it's real important that the public has an idea of why there is certain action taken on a bill. If you or your client, and I feel this strongly, and I feel this whether I was a Democrat or a Republican, if you or your client do not want to disclose their position on an issue, they should not be involved in the process. It's just, to me, that's just really clear. In Colorado, we have a system where we report monthly. I know the bill you have in Oregon is quarterly. We report monthly. Once we get the bills in the system that we're basically following or adding to, it really is not a hard method to do. We just go in once a month. The client's already in there. The bills that we put in before are already still there. And if you've got any updates, you put them in. And if you don't, you know, you put in the amount of money you made that month, and you say submit. And it really is an easy system. And I think if you have somebody working with you to make sure that it's a friendly, you know, easy system to use, you'll find that. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them.
Yeah, we've got a few here. Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. I guess I have a question. I'm wondering, what do you think, or what is the amount of estimate, what would you estimate to be the amount of time that this would take for an average lobbyist?
You know, I'm going to tell you, like in Colorado, I think yeah. I saw where you guys actually have bills submitted in December, but I can tell you the first month, it takes a little longer. Mm-hmm. You're putting in as the bills come along. You know, we start ours in January, and so January or February time frame takes a little longer, because you have to input, you know, the bill numbers and that type of thing. Lots of times you don't have to put in new clients because people hold them over. So it just depends on your situation. If you are a new lobbyist and you've got new clients, it's going to take you a little longer. If you're a lobbyist that's had the same clients, all you're asked to do is really go in and put their the number of the bills that you're following. And for anybody in an active session, you know that bills, at least in Colorado, can be considered late bills, come in later. You'll have to, for the next month, go in and update that bill. But, you know, this last month, and I'm honest with you, I only have one client now. You know, it probably took me 3 or 4 minutes. And if I was doing what my former love was, oh, you know, it would have depended on whether or not we had amendments or if the bill had died or whatever, because, you know, you go in and you enter that type of information. But I wouldn't have guessed more than 15 minutes. The first month or two, maybe 30, maybe 45. But I have to tell you, I was one of those lobbyists that always had a report each week for my whoever I was representing. And so I would have just had to re-enter that information into that database. So it, in my opinion, it's not that difficult to do. Now, some people may find that it is, but I'm not the best computer person in the world, but I don't find it, at least in Colorado, to be of a problem. To me, it's just something that's expected of me in my job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Additional questions? Representative McLean.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today. Has the database ever been used in a campaign in Colorado?
You know, I couldn't answer that, but I will tell you, if I wasn't comfortable, I'm trying to think of how it would be used in a campaign.
Well, I could give you quite a few examples of how I would use it in a campaign. For an example, let's say a moderate Democrat votes no on a bill, and Tea Party of Colorado lobbied for no on the bill, never talked to the Democrat, but in a primary against a very liberal Democrat, the hit piece says, lobbied by the Tea Party to vote no, voted no with the Tea Party, even though there's no affiliation. We saw that here in the general election, where someone had no affiliation with the Oregon Tea Party, and yet you'd think they were a member based upon the volume of ads they were used to hit this person. So I'd be kind of curious in Colorado if you've ever seen ads that point to that database and connect it to somehow someone's vote.
No, I haven't ever seen any. I'm not telling you there couldn't have been, but I didn't see them. But I will tell you that I think almost anybody can make up anything to say about anybody today, whether it's true or not. All you have to
do is... Could be agreement.
Party member saying, you know, I talked to him or I wrote him, and that's why he did what he did, something. So I think you really can write anything almost any day about anyone of you folks, or what I used to be, and it's gotten to be kind of a crazy world that way, but I've never seen it used that way. I guess I could imagine somebody saying, a union said to vote no on this bill, and the person voted no. Well, you know, I guess it's that person's position to say why he voted no. And I know sometimes that comes at a later campaign, but we've all experienced that, I think.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Vicki. I appreciate this. Just a simple question, though. If a lobbyist sponsors an amendment, their name goes on that amendment. In Colorado, if a legislator sponsors an amendment, does their name also go on to that amendment?
Well, that amendment has, I think I've got your question, but an amendment in Colorado has to be offered by a legislator, a member of that committee or the, you know, or the floor. And so basically the whatever group that might have said, you know, this is an amendment we'd like for you to consider, excuse me, in the paperwork it would show that, or in the recording actually of the committee hearing, it would say that ABC group asked the committee to consider this amendment. But it would be offered by a member of the committee, and their name would be the only one on it.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent. Additional questions? Well, thank you, Ms. Armstrong, for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for listening.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
All right, and then Dan Bates, we have signed up. And that's it, so if there's anybody else who wants to testify, let me know now. All right, Mr. Bates.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chairs Rayfield and McLean, thanks for the opportunity to be here. Happy birthday, Oregon. I brought my Valentine's Day tie. I'm Dan Bates. I'm the Volunteer Capital Club Board of Directors President. And as a brief background on the Capital Club, we're a group of organizations of folks that are registered by the Oregon Government Ethics Commission that commit through membership to a code of conduct and that pay our dues. There are about 450 of us. The overall number of folks registered are much greater than that. The agency can probably provide you what that delta is. We'd welcome Executive Director Burson as a member. It sounds like we'd welcome Nikki Armstrong and Mike Beasley as well as members of the Capital Club. In addition to the requirements that are in ORS 171 as to how we have to conduct ourselves, we agree as a standard of conduct to require honesty, a correction of inadvertent information, identification of clients and material. We create a framework for members to avoid the appearance of impropriety, such as refusing to make promises of campaign contributions during session or during days of legislative committee meetings. We avoid close proximity to locations when the chamber doors are closed, such as the House floor. We avoid visiting, not that we've been invited recently, the House and Senate member lounges. Members agree to participate and cooperate with our Professional Responsibility Committee, which regulates and, when appropriate, sanction members of the Capital Club for violation of our bylaws and standard of conduct. Our membership includes contract lobbyists like myself, in-house lobbyists with labor organizations, nonprofit organizations, governments, issue advocacy groups, business organizations, and for-profit businesses. We often don't see eye to eye on legislation. We all do agree to commit ourselves to a level of professionalism in the way that we interact with each other, with you, and with the others in this building. We take that seriously. We take our role in this process seriously. And it's with this background that I approach House Bill 2577. I want to thank Representative Rayfield for reaching out to me and to others late last year on this bill. We agree with the representative's desire for transparency and making sure that the information that we have available to us is easily obtained and well understood. We're committed to working with him and to you in improving transparency where it needs improvement. The Capital Club has discussed this legislation. Our legislative committee has met and began meeting with a number of different types of members within the Capital Club for whom this type of legislation affects their clients and them in very different ways. We don't have a position on the bill today. We're continuing to have those discussions. We appreciate Representative Rayfield's invitation to spend time with us and understand its impact on us and to our clients. We understand that there may be changes that are needed, and we're committed to making sure those changes, again, improve transparency where it needs improvement. But I want to offer up some reflections as a lobbyist looking at this bill today as it's presently introduced. On the topic of reporting each bill on which I engage lobbying activity, you saw a lot of different definitions. And again, I want to preface by one of our overriding concerns in disclosure is making sure that what is disclosed is actually used to produce accurate information, information the public can actually rely upon. And so on the topic of reporting each bill that I engage, it's not exactly clear what fits in that, so I would tell you that I would report on any bill that I have a client that has an interest in which I may interact with a legislator, that legislator's staff, permanent staff in this building, executive branch or agency officials, or other stakeholders that are interested in influencing that legislation. To be clear, by the time the session is over for some of my clients, that's probably over 1,000 bills. It's not the 150 or 250 that were mentioned today. If you multiply that by a score of clients, Mr. Beasley mentioned 30, and then multiply that against, in my office, about 6 different employees who register for each of our clients, collectively in a reporting period, that's an extraordinary number of entries. Entries so numerous across the lobby that it would produce little quality information in the public. we would swamp the public. We've discussed this issue with Representative Rayfield, and I understand he has a desire to figure out how to make that a manageable number. But the amount of entries looks different than the examples that you were given today, and it depends on how the draft ends up. The position of a client on a bill. It's common for a client to change a position multiple times in a month, in a week, and sometimes in a day. The legislation calls for providing the position of that client. It's not clear when that position would have to be reported. If a position changes the day after a reporting requirement, we will have just presented inaccurate and frankly dead wrong information on a particular bill. And the hard work of building coalitions and seeking consensus can be destroyed by that misinformation. Other states have done it. You've heard the examples today. How you report that matters in terms of the quality of information that the public is actually getting. Those are two examples we can spend time, and we've chatted with Representative Rayfield, but things relating to the compensation of lobbyists, how do you attribute that within a firm? It looks differently in for-profit and nonprofit and firms. All of that is not entirely clear on how you would do that. It's important to have those discussions because, again, the information you want to provide, you want to be accurate. You want it to be reliable. My concerns as I look at the bill as drafted, and again, really deeply appreciate and want to work with Representative Rayfield in getting this correct. The OGEC, as you heard the conversation earlier, has a new technology with regard to reporting. For many of us, that reporting has been fantastic in that we're able to do it electronically when it works. In December, nearly every lobbyist and their clients received a notification that we hadn't submitted our quarterly four reports in error of the law. In doing that, there's now a public record that a lot of folks violated the law. That wasn't the intent. It was clearly a technology glitch. It's really, really important that the system works if you're going to use this public information that's out there and then layering on new information. It's really important for that data to be reliable. It's important for the public trust. It's important for us. It's important for you. And so it's really important that the OGEC has the resources it needs if it's going to embark on this to make sure that we're delivering accurate information. I'll conclude my remarks again for thanking Representative Rayfield for engaging us, and for the chairs for giving us an opportunity to be here. We're committed to good governance. We're committed to transparency. We're committed to making sure that we operate in professional ways and that the public has the information it needs to understand what's going on. And I look forward to remaining engaged on behalf of the Capital Club and its members.
Thank you.
Happy to answer questions.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2577. Is there any business left for the committee for today? All right. With that, we are adjourned.